Two Pints in a Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner. There's Desmond. We usually have Tony Rain with me, but Tony's sick quite now, and we hope he gets well pretty soon, because Peter Limbo is with me, and we love him to come and work with us. Tony and Peter together is an amazing combination. But Peter's with me doing some fun stuff, and we're coming to talk with you about the Bent Men and other things that you guys did at the Channel. And
Oh, wow. That was a great time, I'll tell you.
Well, that's what we want to hear from you guys, because what we're after is your stories and your times, whether you were working, whatever band you were working with, some of those stories, and also some of the people that you and Catherine, your wife, would go and see and watch. And then later you'd use, or they'd come over to the museum to doing their rehearsals with you and stuff.
Well, that's right. Anyways, the Channel. When I remember back when we first played at the Channel, we thought, wow, you know, that we had reached a new level. We had done the Longview, I think it's not Longview. Well, I think it's the Longview Theater over at Emerson. We played there. Those were the bigger ones. Prior to that, it was, you know, it was the Rat downstairs, the Down Under, which was like downtown Boston area. And before that, Chet. So we sort of worked our way up. So once we got to the level of doing the theaters and doing the Channel and packing it, too, we played two shows only at the Channel. We packed both of them out.
As the Bent Men, though. You're talking about the Bent Men now.
We're talking about the Bent Men. My first band in Boston was called the Replicant Rubbers.
I like that name. You have some great names.
Yeah, I like that name, too. But, you know, that was the first one, which was actually sort of the baby Bent Men, in that we were doing doing theatrical stuff with the show, you know, wearing costumes and things like that. I am, as a performer, you know, I had major stage fright when I first started. So I transformed and was protected behind a mask.
That makes sense.
So, well, yeah, I mean, just to be honest about it, you know, so I had to grow through that. And, you know, and I realized this is great because you can have anybody in the band, too. And, you know, we had several members. Some of them quite famous, went on to be quite famous. But the Channel was a comeuppance in that we had played smaller venues. And I think we had 14 or 1,600 people.
Yep. That sound about right? That's about right.
That's not a sellout, but it was packed.
Yep.
You know, and we, oh, my goodness. We were so thrilled when we played there. And you know, we got treated very well. There was a crabby sound guy, I think, at the time.
What year was that?
Oh, it's in the 80s.
I know. What 80s?
So 84 we started, so give it a couple of years of, you know, playing here and there at the different venues. So maybe 86.
I think that was Dinky, who was the sound man that sucked.
I was probably the crabby sound guy in 84, because that's when I came in, not 86. I came in 84.
Well, I have to tell you, you know, Mr. Dawson, you are a legend, you know, all over the world, I think. You know, and I always looked up to you whenever your name popped up. And you know, and so this is really, you know, so many years later, you know, the Bent Men still exists, but I have, you know, I've had some medical issues over the last, you know, 15, 20 years of pretty serious stuff, but I'm still here.
Yeah.
You can't kill me.
And Dinky and I have that same conversation every Wednesday.
Every Wednesday we have the same thing. Peter will hardly be here with his back doing the number.
And I've just come off a dialysis the day before, and I have the day off today, and then I go back tomorrow and then the next day.
But keep hanging in there, brother.
It's the same with you, you know.
Thank you. The last show that we did was 218. That was at once the big room they had.
Ah, yeah.
And we haven't played since. So is there going to be another show? I have no idea. You know, it's just I'm still kind of recovering from a major operation.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things going on with, in my life with the Sound Museum. And, you know, I'm not going to get into that because it's kind of a depressing thing that my rehearsal complex. But, you know, I've been in the business, the music business, the band rehearsal studios and the recording business. And then radio business briefly for about 6 years with WEMF.
Wow.
That was an online thing.
Yeah.
We were one of the biggest and when we were operating, which was out of the Sound Museum. And so I guess I've been around, you know. Been around a long time now since I was in my 20s. So.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the cool thing is you've done a lot of varied things, man. I find that fascinating, you know. Yeah.
And now you've been doing a performance room up in Norwood. Peter,
the magic room, right? The magic room.
Yep.
That's a really fun place. And we have some, exciting news coming up that I'm not at privy to talk about right at the moment, but probably within a week or so. We're teaming up and with somebody, who's very big in the arts and film and everything else. So we'll see what happens, but, I'm still hanging in there. You know, I'm 68 years old now.
You're a puppy.
The part that I'm talking of in the magic room, is that in that same big warehouse with David Bieber and stuff with his archive?
Yes, it is. Yes, right now. In fact, that's one of the reasons I went to that particular complex because of David Bieber, who's a friend of mine, and I love what he's doing there. He's, they've got all of the archives that he used to have in a warehouse in Avon. He collected everything.
Everything with a capital E, man.
I remember when, I won't say his name, but with, one of the DJs over at BCN is coming into In Your Ear and carrying all the bands, that sent stuff over for promo. just to unload it in those used record stores. But Bieber didn't do anything like that, man. He collected posters, big ones, small ones, albums, T-shirts. He's got stuff from the Bentman shows over there.
Well, I was told that David wanted two of everything when somebody promo guy came in. He's a smart cat, man. He really is.
Keep all that stuff. No, the reason
he's an eccentric, and he's got it finally organized over there, so it's all cataloged, so you can actually find this stuff, just not in boxes in a warehouse. So they've done a lot of work over there, and so several years ago I went over there. He encouraged me to go there.
Yeah, we actually talking with David next week, next Wednesday. Today is at the Cabot place, talking with the Cabot to put some of the stuff in the Cabot there on loan. And
the Cabot Theater up in Beverly.
That one.
Okay, so you're a part of that.
He told me because I talked with him yesterday, and the other thing that before we go onto anything else. Just so you know, Peter Limbo actually used to play in that place as a kid.
In which place?
Where you're at. I could throw a baseball from my mother's house into Norwood. And I
would, that was the old bird asphalt.
It was all kinds of places, and it was disgusting. And I can remember, we used to go over there all the time, and finally the cops came and just said, kids
still do it.
Do you understand all the crap that's in here that's not good for you? And, finally convinced our parents that we weren't going to go over there and play anymore. But back in the day, man, it was It smelled like God only knows, I can tell you.
Did you take over the antiques room there? Did you take over the antiques room when they had
the
antiques?
No. The antiques room, that's, what the hell is that called? Savage Angel. No, we took over a tile showcase space. And then I painted it black, so it looks like, you know, what people are living in these days and different. It's amazing what a little flat black paint will do.
There you go.
It really is amazing when you think about it. But that's the norm now. Everybody wants to be blacked out and stuff, and then put a few bit of color in the lights.
Well, I'll tell you something. I put about $60,000+ worth of trick lighting in there.
Wow.
That, you know, maybe in the House of Blues wouldn't have an impact, but in five screens up on the walls, kind of like, you know, Lansdowne Street back in the mid-'80s.
Wow.
And we run the weirdest stuff in there, you know, just incredible stuff that I found online, and, you know, donations and things like that from all over the world. And we run it up on the screen, so the room really sort of just comes alive with that alone. But then you add these lasers and stuff in a room it's only 2,850 square feet, so, and it holds 125 people. So it is an intimate room with a, you know, the magic room is a very big vibe in there. So
it's great for performance art, that size.
Yes, it is. And we had Melanie coming, actually, but she passed away on me.
Oh, wow.
You know, Melanie from, you know, the Woodstock era.
Yeah.
So I wanted to have some celebrities like that. And she was going to play with her daughter. And we were setting it up. And then it would have been a $45, $50 ticket, which is a little high for us. We're around $25, which is really nothing
today.
That's
a very reasonable ticket nowadays.
That's really reasonable today. Everything else is over 40, $60.
Okay. You guys, let's talk a little bit about the channel and what I can remember about that place.
Great stuff.
I have a couple of stories from beyond the Bentman. I used to go to the channel all the time.
Great.
And so we had, I don't know if you know it, I don't even know what you call it, but these, you crank them up from the back and there's a small 4-foot platform on it. And it's used by people that are doing sheetrock 20, 25 feet up. In a building. And I got a hold of two of those things and we decorated them like jack-in-the-boxes. Okay.
And I think we can sense what's coming here.
Yeah. Well, I got inside one of them and then partner there, Ross Kennedy, his name, who's like, he's vice president of Credit Suisse. I don't know what he's doing now, but you know, he's always hiding behind a mask because he can't show himself. And he's from England, by the way.
Okay.
But So we're in these things and we have someone, an assistant, cranking them up and we're kind of coming out of the box. You know.
But
people were flipping out over that. And it was just, you know, we used to create stuff with nothing.
Yeah. That's the
thing. Oh, and we had these power sprayers. This is before the Blue Man Group were using them, you know, where we were spraying, you know, all kinds of crudge out of the thing into the audience. And basically, they were leaf blowers.
Yeah.
But they were.
And I'm sure the audience was loving it.
Oh, they got covered. They were choking on feathers. And the club was so pissed. It was too... 2 feet of gunk all the way back to that second bar that they had made a few years later. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And I got a story about that. I was hanging out back there having a beer with this guy named Hans. This wasn't a Bentman show, but, you know, I'm saying, wow, there's somebody up on stage, and that woman sounds, you know, just like Mary Ann's Faithful, and is doing broken English, and I'm saying, holy shit. She's good, man. That sounds just like her. And Tom says, it is her. So I turned around. You know, she was living around Cambridge, I guess.
That's right.
But I didn't know that. Yeah.
She played, though.
yeah, it was, and she was amazing. I couldn't believe it. She's one of my heroes. Anyway, but, I mean, just so many little things that happen over at the channel. I helped work on sound over there for the Biker's Ball a couple of times.
Oh, what nights those were!
Oh, they were outrageous.
The Witch's Ball, I think they called it, right?
Oh, the Witch's Ball that was at a more Halloweenish.
Don't know. It was the Hell's Angels thing. Yeah. We were doing. I met Al Hogan, who was the president.
Oh, yeah. Al, absolutely.
Mario.
And Mario. He hired me. Yeah. He hired me. I was at a biker rally, and I went because I've been into the Harleys since I was 16. Although I just sold my last one just about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, my.
You know, that was it. I'm getting out of it. I figure I've lived my life, as it were, and I don't feel lucky anymore. So I'm just with that sort of a thing. So, you know, for at least the time being, I got rid of my last bike. But I've been riding forever, and I know I'm already missing it, but it's safer for me.
That's why you go on the tractor all the time and the big stuff like that and have fun.
I was on a tractor just 2 days ago.
2 days
ago, 90 horsepower John Deere. Yeah, it was fixed on my drive up in Vermont.
Okay.
So, that's a monster of a tractor.
the big ones for farm work, oh, my goodness, they're so heavy to deal with, but they work forever.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I love that machine. But anyway, so, yeah, there's so many stories. And when we get, like I said, when we got in there and when we played, it was we made such a mess that we were always looking over our shoulder. We didn't know if we were going to, get beaten up or something because, I mean, the mess was legendary in that place, the Bentman. Some of the things that we did there and introduced at the channel, we did at other places. A friend of mine, Jack Merry, from Duxbury, Mass., he'd been around music, Duke and the Drivers and all that stuff forever and ever. He brought the three Blue Man Groups guys, the original three guys, out to see us. And, you know, next thing I see on TV on an ad with Intel is them spraying stuff up on a wall with blowers.
That was really...
So I said to my wife, Catherine, and a couple of band members, Jesus Christ, that looks a lot like what we're doing. Because we did it a little bit, you know, it was like a 10-cent version, and they put it on national television, probably got paid $500,000 to do it. But we did it. And I said, to a couple of band members, I said, we did a couple of these things at the channel way back when.
Yep.
And my wife is saying, oh man, don't give your ego. It's the Blue Man Group. They've been on Jay Leno. They've been on this, that, the other thing. They don't know anything about us.
Hey, I call you a trendsetter, you know.
If we copied anybody at all, or let's not call it a copy, but an inspiration, it's the Residents out of San Francisco, because, you know, it's more cerebral than, let's say, Guar that makes a big mess.
Yeah.
And the difference between Guar and the Bentman is we never clean up after us. We just leave it, you know.
They guys cleaned every single part of the channel, them guys, when I was there. They cleaned everything, including damn duct tape off the drum riser. I couldn't believe
it. We threw 200 ice cream sandwiches off the stage at the channel.
I like that.
We always put on. We have a song called "The Ice Cream Clown," and I won't go into the whole thing, but everything, all the lyrics that I write, are very cerebral for me and have meaning, and it's very basic if you listen to the words, but it play on words or whatever. There was a gentleman from Duxbury when I was a young kid who sort of lost his mind because he got tabbed at a party.
Oh, no.
And so it's kind of a sad story in that way. But for a little while, he came back and he had one of those Good Humor ice cream trucks. Okay. And he was down, and I ride down there on my bike, and I see him. He snapped a little bit. He's throwing the ice cream sandwiches out of the truck at the kids that are picking them up. right? And chowing on them. And he had this horrible $2, $5 and $10 mask with, like, not a mask, but a bald head with red hair and a little cherry nose with a rubber band. It was like $5, right?
Yeah.
And he was wearing that in the truck while he was having a little bit of a meltdown. You know, everybody treated him a little special because, you know, he had gone off the deep end at one time and he was working his way back, a hard worker. Nothing bad to say about him, but it was just the way I saw it. It was like, you know, it was a surreal imagery for me as a kid. So what we do is, to cut to the chase, we talk about this beach setting, and we end up, the shtick in the thing, that, you know, is throwing ice cream sandwiches, coming out wearing that same outfit that he was wearing, and throwing ice cream sandwiches into the crowd. Usually about 200 of them would throw.
Oh, no.
And by the time they got out there, they were mushy, you know, partially mushy and everything.
That sounds like
down the road and on Lansdowne Street.
Nothing better than melting ice cream sandwiches and flat beer, you know? what a combination.
And the audience covered in gack from us, you know, hitting them every other time. And bending over, stoned and drunk, and picking up those ice cream sandwiches and chowing on them, they're like dripping down. It's one of our things anyway. So I always get a good little smile out of that. But the channel in particular, we said, we're going to take advantage of this. And we always went in with the idea that we were never going to get asked back, so let's just hammer this place, you know? But and then I think it closed down for a while, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure what happened over there, but, you know, it was all done.
92.
Then it opened up. Yeah, isn't there something weird that happened over there, maybe?
Yeah.
92, the personnel changed, the owners and whatever, they were trying to sell it, and then it just changed. I took everything out and put all my gear and all the sound gear, took all the TVs, took everything out. And left the old original disc jockey stuff because that wasn't really mine. That was really the club's. And
Somebody had an idea to turn it into a strip joint.
And that's what they did.
And, oh, okay.
So we'd long gone. I'd already long gone, and not long gone, but gone and what have you. It wasn't it wasn't worth me. I mean, the guy owed so much money and stuff. I said, that's it. Next. And
there was somebody that was booking that place, an older gentleman working at an antique store down in Dennis. He was one of the
Tony.
I'm not sure, but he said he recognized me. He says, "Oh Jesus, you didn't bring those sprayers with you." You know, I'm a thrift store guy, and I like really weird antiques and classic masks and everything. Kind of my personality is kind of why the band was the way it was in a lot of ways. You know, I like the weirdness, and it's just who I am. And, you know, we came up with a few different ideas. A couple of them we experimented with at the channel first, and then we went on and we did them at Mama Ken's. We absolutely destroyed that place, Mama Ken's, with brand new dressing room.
Oh, no.
Then our lighting guy, Justin Keith, backed his bread truck right into, what's his face, the guy that owned the place. He owned it with Aerosmith still at that time. Lions.
The Lions brothers, yep.
Yeah, he backed it. I think it was Patrick Lyons. He backed his the truck. Right. We made a mess of the club. I'm talking about 2.5 feet deep, all the way back from the stage, right? And then on top of that, they were pissed about that, but they forgave us because we played there at Momikin's like 4 times, I think.
Wow.
But they hated what we did to the place, but they loved the show.
Well, the funny thing is Aerosmith did their civic duty in destroying dressing rooms and stuff. So having been Tim Collins, Aerosmith's manager's best friend at the time, I can attest. to the fact that they were.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
You know, getting revenge. You know? I didn't think about that. And Steven Tyler once came when we played the Boston Music Awards when it was something, you know, played at the Orpheum Theater.
Oh, yeah.
And we had a 40-foot puppet that came up on a hydraulic lift. And, I remember whispering in Joyce Cole Haywick, she had a run off to do the, she would come early. And so I had told, I think Candace Avery was the one that was doing those things back then. And she says, yeah, we want you guys to play. Well, Jack Mary, the guy that was friends with the original Blue Man Group guys, right?
Yeah.
He says, you got to get the Bentman in there because you got, you know, another reward for Aerosmith already. You got to have, you know, at least some diversion, something different. So she called us up and she wanted to put us on at some other venue, which was leading up to it. And I said, no, this is, I mean, the balls I had sometimes, you know, I just said, no, we'll play, but we're going to play in the first hour because that's when everybody's there, you know, instead of out drinking beer in the lobby.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So I said, you know, we'll do it. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. But we're going to do it in the first hour. And you're going to give us 15 minutes, which is unheard of because it's up and down, you know.
Yeah.
So, and she did, you know. Well, she hung up, and Jack told me, she says, who the hell is this Dez guy? Who does he think he is? Right? And Jack told me later on the phone, it's so long ago, so I don't mind saying this. He says, oh, she was pissed. She was throwing things. You know, I guess she was over by the old BCN across the street. She says, who the hell is this guy? And Jack says, the other guys are going to give us something different for the show. So, you know, who else are you going to get? You're not going to get the residents, and they're right in town. And, of course, we wanted it. But so I saw Joyce Cole Haywick there early when we were getting our stuff in there. And I went down, tapped her on the back of the shoulder, and I said, the band you want to see is this whack job band called the Bentman. So she stayed an extra half an hour because she had to get over for the 11 o'clock news.
I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second. We got to remember here that Joyce Cole Haywick was the straightest of the straightest of the news people, okay? So I can only imagine what's going to happen.
Oh, yes. Well, let me tell you something. She's a sweetheart. She didn't know who I was, all right? I was just this guy that was, you know, behind her. And I wanted to make sure we got, because I knew we weren't going to win anything, even though we were up for best band or song. I said, who the hell is listening to our stuff? But who the hell beat us? I forget. Too bad Eddie, our guitarist, isn't here. He always knows the details of these things. But he stayed, and at 11 o'clock news, all she talked about was the Bentman.
She enjoyed it.
I love it.
It was a guerrilla move. Yeah. It worked.
I think it was really good move. The Bentman did it again. Oh, my goodness. I love it. Performance out.
But listen, I want to say, you know, I want to put you guys on a pedestal again. And, you know, thank you for reaching out. And the channel is such a iconic place. I had so much fun there. I learned a lot about performing there. As an individual, you know, because I kind of started late, you know, with the, you know, doing the performance art stuff. And I mean, I was in my 20s, but, you know, still people were starting at 16, 17. I didn't get going until I was 25.
That's me. You did performance art then. I did performance art in 1969 at Royal Albert Hall. I put in two giant parabolic speakers, red, attached to the to the organ under there just for vocals. And what I did is I just put vocals in, and we had B.B. King and Fleetwood Mac and Plain. And then all these people like Mick Jagger and the Stones were up in the booth up there, and Mick told me after, he says, that's the greatest transvestite stuff. I says, no. You've got the greatest transvestite. You've got the 200-foot dick that blows up. He says, do you want to borrow it? So I says, yeah, I'll borrow it. So I borrowed it for Roundhouse Chalk Farm gig, the last gig that Fleetwood did, and and I put the actual dick on top of this thing that goes around the building, and it throbbed and whatever, and the two parabolas over the top of that, so it looked like definitely a transvestite of some kind, but
oh, that's so cool.
But Peter Green, first song, he's looking at this thing throbbing. He goes, "They have a mind of their own, them things." And he was going throbbing up and down, bashing Mick on the head. It was so big.
Goodness.
Mick Fleetwood was like freaking out, and then Mick Jagger and them were just loving it, absolutely loving it. I mean, I said, "That was my bit of performance. That's all I ever did. That was the only one we did, because we used to come on stage as a blues band." Our roadies that were with us, one of them used to come on with a silver plate with a huge dildo on the front that we strapped to Mick's drum. So every time he'd do the kick drum, it would go blub, 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 and wobble around and wobble around. We got told off about that when we made number one with Albatross. We were told not to do any more of that. Clifford got mad with us, our manager. "We got to take that away. We got to hide Harold down. We don't do that stuff." But we were crazy when we were doing that. We were having fun, just having a bit of fun. But you took it to the extreme with all the stuff that you were chucking out and everything, and people like Chris Brunell with the big mask he had on all the time. I was like, "Wow, that's pretty cool." Stuff.
Oh yes, oh yeah. You're talking about Chris Burble?
Burble, that's it. Yeah, he's fun.
Yeah, Chris is just called me yesterday. He wants to get together. Yeah, he's a good guy, and he's got, you know, he's a hefty dude. So the two of us, I've lost a lot of weight, you know.
Being ill, yeah.
Oh, man, I was up there 275, and Chris is, you know, up beyond that at one time. And we have these foam heads that we had made ourselves.
The foam. Yeah,
and, well, we did like a Tweedledee, Tweedledum thing. So we, you know, we come waddling in with a big, you know, sweaty guts, and we're bouncing off each other's belly, and then we reach up and we've got foam heads. We're spraying the foam off the top of the heads. I mean, we handmade the mask out of plaster of Paris. I mean, you know, every once in a while I will use a Halloween costume, but what we mostly did and still do is try to not do that. It's because it's a little too obvious, and one show that we did, and I think it may have been the second show at the channel, I didn't have any ideas that were affordable to us. So, I raised my kids in Weymouth, in across from the Great Pond Reservoir. And I went in there, and I said, "Wow, look at all these really strange sort of birch branches." And I started breaking some branches off of some of the dead trees in there, and I made costumes out of that. Like headdresses with branches. It didn't cost us anything, just some time and trying to be creative. And man, that have a, with the right lighting and everything, that was a real spooky stage. That, you know, really was.
Definitely better. You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
The creative music that you guys created has really affected your family. Every one of you, like the young Casey that come along, she's been doing amazing stuff.
Yes, she has, and thank you for acknowledging her. She just had a baby 4 months ago, first one, and it's the first time I'm a grandfather.
And boy, is that,
yeah, she's putting pictures up there. She still keeps her maiden name, Casey Desmond. She played, and I got a story if you don't mind me bragging a little bit about her. Not at the Magic Room, but at the Sound Museum. We did a lot of recording in Barefoot Studios, you know. Yeah. That building has been torn down. It was 155 North Beacon Street.
Yeah.
And I'm in there, and she had lost her bass player because, I don't know, he was moving away, something, his girlfriend, you know, and it just kind of plopped in on her right when she was getting going. And we were in the studio recording. Well, I'm saying to the engineer, Taylor Barefoot, you know, that's the namesake, and Taylor played in her band too, and he was quite talented. And I said, "We got to get a bass player for these recordings because she's pumping out songs left and right." And early on, she was doing singer-songwriter stuff, and she kind of morphed into really dark electronica now. It has for the last 10 years or so. But anyways, who can we get? He says, well, I know this guy that I worked up at Imaginary Road Studios, which is Will Ackerman, you know, from Windham Hill Records.
Oh, yeah. You know,
ambient stuff.
Yeah.
And I said, he was looking around for this guy, but they never got him. And I said, what's his name? Tony Levin. I said, what? I said, he's the guy from King Crimson, you know, and from Peter Gabriel's band. He says, yeah. Yeah, I think he played, you know, he doesn't know. He's younger, right? And he doesn't know really who he played with, except, you know, that was the name. And I said, shit, I know that guy. Are you kidding me? He's a legend, you know? And so we called him because he had his number. And he lives up, you know, upstate New York with Jerry Marotta.
A friend of mine, yeah.
I love Jerry, yeah. And so people don't realize that he was in that band Orleans.
That was me. You know,
yeah. So I said, do you think he'll do it? He doesn't know or anything. He goes, well, let's call and find out. Well, he picked up the phone, and he was in between the big gigs, and he, you know, he's for hire in the recording studio. Of course, he doesn't want to do it unless, you know, somebody's a schmuck, you know, would put his name to it. So Tony says, we have him on the speakerphone. He says, let me, do you have any music you can play of hers? You know, so he says, yeah, I could put it on here. You think you can hear it on the phone? He says, oh, yeah. So he plays, I don't know, must be 13, 15 seconds, not even that long, Casey. And he said, he says, shut it off. He says, I'll do it. He says, when you've been in the business as long as me, you can tell in the first two or three notes.
Totally.
All it takes.
That's what he said. And he came right out, and they recorded in two sessions 14 songs together. So wow. It wasn't just like one song. He's on 14 of her songs that she has.
Fantastic.
It really is. So, you know, Dinky, I have actually a clip of that from the old Boston, I forget the name of the goddamn thing. I'm forgetting everything. I didn't forget you, though.
No.
But I have a video clip of that, of a few minutes of that. I'll send it to you so you can actually see her in the studio working with them. But anyhow, so then, you know, I was able to get Tony to play on some of my ambient music. Because, you know, yeah, there's the Bentman, but in some of the early songs, I'm playing the Persian Santor. People is, what the hell is that? Well, I say hammer dulcimer because that's what they call it here. But this Persian Santor has more of an antique sound, more biblical. You know, it's got that twang to it, almost like a sitar.
Oh.
So, you know, I like that instrument a little bit better because I like how gothic it can feel in the studio with a couple of foot pedals.
Yeah.
So I got Tony to work on that with me, along with Will Ackerman. Who actually rejected me. He rejected me back in the 80s when I did two albums with that music. He says, no, this is, you know, we're going to go with Lil Raji. You know, Lil Raji ends up on, you know, Brian Eno's label.
Oh, Brian Eno.
You know, so he went with Lil Raji instead of me. But, you know, years later, I'm ended up working in the recording studio with him, you know, and we're recording an album. So, and I said, hey, you rejected me, buddy.
Yeah, I love it.
And who's the, oh God, I forget the names. It would be, make the story a little more potent, but Will Ackerman, before he cashed out and had done so well with George Winston, who, you know, with the ambient piano, I mean, Universal paid $5 million for Windham Hill Records. You know, and then by the, you know, early 90s, the whole damn thing was over. You know, no one cared too much.
Yeah, it's all
except for me. Yeah.
Change.
Right. Except for me. Right. So I don't know if I have any more stories about the channel.
Well, I figured you've got a few because, you know, what you did there, that was the... But is there anything that you watched there that was nothing to do with any acts that you're working with, but... Just going there just to see something.
Well, a lot of the bands did, local bands.
Yeah.
Played at, I saw Iggy Pop there, right?
Yeah, that's that became an album, that show.
Yeah, that was a great show. And Iggy ends up over during the American Caesar album he did. During that period of time, I walk into room 34, which had Reeves Cabrel. You know, Reeves is with The Cure now and played with Bowie for many years. But he was, Reeves was one of the guitarists that played in the Bentmen back then.
Wow.
A lot of people don't know that, but, you know, but you couldn't tell who was who on stage. Reeves was in the band for...
That's the key for the Bentmen. They couldn't tell who was on stage.
That's right, because we could trade people off. Anyway, so Iggy Pop is up there,
yep.
With Eric Schimmerhorn, who's in Red, maybe. I'm forgetting some of the bands now, so many years ago. But Eric Schimmerhorn was playing with a guy named Hal. They all used to play at the Channel. And Iggy was up in their rehearsal room. So I walk in. I don't even notice him. I'm going in to talk to him about some business, you know, the rent for the room.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, when is that coming in? And I always had to, you know, help people sometimes, you know, like all the time. They didn't have their money. And when is Reeves coming back? Because I'd like to talk to him. And then Eric points over there and he says, why don't you say hi? And it's Iggy is sitting right in the dressing, in the rehearsal room. So he stands up, pulls out his pud, right? And he starts swinging it at me. He did. He just pulls it out, and he starts swinging at me like this. And I'm saying, oh, wow, this is really cool, man. Iggy Pop is swinging his dick at me.
I know, Dinky's getting all excited here. Let's keep it down.
Well, let me just finish the story. The next day, I went up there, and Reeves was there, and I said, Iggy pulled out his pud, he's swinging it around at me, and Reeves very just calmly, like, you know, like a school teacher. I mean, he says, don't get too excited. He does that to everybody.
I love it.
That's funny.
That's funny.
That is
because he was wild on stage. He did great art on stage when he got going on there. When he put his
Residence. Residence was another big one at the Channel. The Residence. I saw the Residence. And in fact, I think right after that, one of the eyeballs got stolen. One of the eyeball head costumes.
No.
I don't know if it happened at the Channel, but they were talking about it there.
Oh, it might have
probably happened somewhere along the tour.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
Yeah. But one of the eyeball heads that was an iconic thing for them had disappeared from their, you know, truck.
Well, that's what people used to do. If they didn't couldn't get anything out of their truck, they would take the tires or the, you know, this is what they used to do in England. They'd write all over the trucks with lipstick and,
yep.
And all that stuff and leave their number. And I mean, you drive off, there'd be thousands of damn lipsticks all over the damn thing and stuff. I had it when I watched the Marmalade in, they used to be in the same office we were in London with Fleetwood. And they just kept, we've got to get a new truck. Every day they got a new truck. The damage, it was beyond belief.
Well, my office.
Marmalade, they had one big hit, sort of a ballad type song, right?
Yeah, that's the Marmalade. And then there was, I forget the other one that was very similar to them. And we were, every day they would, when they come back from a gig and stuff, they would end up, no, there's four tires that we need because they took all the wheels and the hubs off and everything.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, yeah, the people.
You know who I ran into the Channel? I ran into him twice, which is really weird. It was Chris Farlow from Atomic Twister.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, he went. I guess he was in Coliseum as well. Big kind of barrel-chested guy.
It was my favorite, one of the favorite songs when he did Out of Time in 1965, I think it was 66. And Chris's version of it was just absolutely brilliant. And
He had such a beautiful voice.
Really, really, really sweet voice to do that. And then he started singing and what have you with lots of other people. I mean, he just, instead of just doing his own thing, you know.
Yeah, right.
The Stones helped him out tremendously and stuff, just like Mary Ann, they helped out, Mary Ann Faithfull. And and that kind of crowd, you know, they were just really loving this kind of these kind of people because they were a lot different than the Stones or the other people that were playing around at that time, you know.
My friend Gary has at Northeast Comic Con, and he does a lot of
Gary Summers. We know Gary very well.
Yeah, Gary Summers and I are good friends.
He's a good guy.
Helped me get. He really is, yeah. Him and Eric Borenstein got me the big, huge heads that I have. Yeah. Eric actually made them. They're all around the inside of the Magic Room, you know, and they're beautiful. Gary says, "Dez, get this out of my bond." I said, "Who did you make these?" He goes, "No." He goes, "Borenstein did." Well, and he has no place to store them because his studio will, you know, in Boston is full to the brim of all kinds of stuff. So I called him and, you know, he has it on permanent display over there.
You first met Gary at Lansdowne Street in one of those places. He was running the production and stuff at one point there.
Well, my daughter did a concert for him, a couple of them with, you know, like, you know, that whole group, John Butcher, you know, Charlie Farron, all of them. And she was the young one that was on the stage during those Christmas.
Was at the Regent. I think I was there first time that they did it.
Yeah. Casey did a version on her Omnicord with Taylor, the studio engineer and guitarist I talked about earlier, and blew everybody through the roof with, you know, because she has multi-octave range.
Yeah, yeah.
And boy, oh boy, did she cream that. Everybody was like, holy shit. I mean, Ernie Bach came over. I thought he was going to write $1 million check.
Or at least give her a car.
Yeah, right, something. But anyways.
And he's funny anyway, you know.
Okay. Yeah. So, anyway, listen, I have a question for you, Dinky. Now, everybody... I've heard a million times that you're on the roof with the Beatles and Let It Be. Are you up there? Because I keep looking for you, and I know you'd be very young then.
No. We were downstairs. Not down on that night, but we'd go into the studio. Well, actually, Peter and Danny.
You know there's a rumor out there. You must know.
Yeah, that's
rumor.
Made by AJ Wattel. I mean, AJ's been saying that for years.
Yep,
no,
gotcha.
I was in London doing the Fleetwood at the time. That's why John Lennon. What happened? We had a number one hit with Albatross, but prior to that, Mick Fleetwood was going out with Jenny Boyd, which is Paddy Boyd's sister, and Mick and John and actually Mick and Peter and Danny Kerwin at the time, the young lad, went down stairs in Abbey Road and they were doing a couple of songs and this, that, and the other, and then. As they're going down the stairs, they see Peter coming down and John starts off with Here Comes the Sun King. And the next thing you know, if you listen to that album, that whole album there, it's very Fleetwood Mac-oriented sound. Very, very, very Fleetwood Mac. Well, I mean, even John turned out to do the Dirty Mac band with a bunch of people and stuff, he's called them. The Dirty Mac, and they all got up there and doing the blues and stuff. But Peter just blew them away when they played down there together. He absolutely just...
Right.
Because he plays less notes than Eric Clapton and people, their friends, you know. And and just the way, using the space for the music was just, you know, something that mind-blowing that Paul McCartney and John just went absolutely nuts over, you know. And that was a good time for us down there at that time period and what have you. And but I didn't do the Abbey Road upstairs. I too busy with Fleetwood running around in London at that time because we were just starting to hit it big everywhere. And every day we were doing 1 to 3 concerts a day. And we were leaving at 7 o'clock in the morning to go up north. We'd do 2 concerts up north and come back on our way at night to do another concert, that kind of thing. But it was if we didn't do it, we wouldn't be getting the money out of anything to be able to keep going because it was the live shows that kept us in business, you know, and kept us going. and what have you. But the music came along. You'd go to the speakeasy at 3 o'clock in the morning after the gig in London, and you'd meet friends there. You know, you'd meet, I'd meet Keith Moon there and have a good time with Keith. And then the
was he as crazy as everybody always? You know, stories.
Keith was a loon, no ifs, no buts. I mean, it was crazy, but he was sensibly crazy at some points before he got too wasted, and then he got really trashed, and it was, like, really bad. But but we'd go down there, and there'd be people like Jimi Hendrix. You know, all the main stars are in the 60s. This is, like, 68, 69. And in 69 down there, you know, they'd have jam sessions. Jimmy would go up and play bass. Peter would play guitar, Eric would be there and they'd play guitar. They'd be all jamming and stuff on that damn stage, and it was so small. It was you know, just one of these little step-up stages and whatever, but it was just wonderful.
Did you ever get a chance to meet Tony McPhee from the Groundhogs?
No, I don't believe so. No, doesn't ring a bell.
He's one of my heroes. You know, he's dead now. I died a few years ago. Or a couple of years ago.
No, mine was John McVie, and my best old friend, John. Yeah. John was wonderful, and then he just married Christine Perfect, or Christine McVie, and this is before Christine ever joined the Fleetwood. I mean, I left in 71 when Peter left at that same time. I knew that band wasn't going to get going again because of Peter. I missed him already. So I joined. Yeah. I joined the Birds and came over here, and that's where I've been. I did the Birds for a few years, and then I did my own company in '72. But and then I did many, many acts after that. '72, Lou Reed, Steely Dan, Mahavishnu Orchestra, you name it. I just did all the '70s acts that were really, really cool. I did made platinum albums for Steely and stuff like that. But
the Mahavishnu Orchestra, I saw them. I think it was '72 or '73. On the Boston Common, there were about 80 people there.
Yeah, I didn't do that one. I did 72 was the first show they ever did in Lenox. And then after that, I was out with the Kinks, you see. And then I came back, and the Kinks had this band opening for them called Steely Dan, and I never heard of them. And then all of a sudden, 3 years later, I get a call from Walter and stuff, and he came over and slept on the couch. where we lived, and says, "You're joining Steely Dan." And next thing I know, it's just the contract out of Mahavishnu that kind of thing from CBS. And I says, whatever you want me to do, I'll come and do it. And it was wonderful, wonderful touring. The band was amazing, absolutely unbelievable from the first note. It was just sensational feeling, you know, every night. Yeah. And I have to say that the best night they ever did actually was in Boston. And it was because the Peers were in the audience, and, you know, being Berkeley people and different schools and stuff, they were all in there. And Michael McDonald and Donald sang so perfect that even when Royce Jones got to, and did his stuff, the harmonies became unbelievable because they could hear all my monitors. You know, and the way that the quality was coming out was just sensational for them. And they just let it rip that night. I blew Pastor off the ceiling in the Orpheum. Billy Cobham played in there with the Mahavishnu. I had Plaster going all over his drums at middle of the night when he did a solo.
Oh, man.
He was doing a solo and the double kick
drum. You written a book yet? You must have written
1987 with 88 with Carter Allen. Oh, 1997. Nancy's quoted.
He's an encyclopedia, too. I bet you're the real.
Yes, he knows more about that time period than anyone I've ever met.
He's unbelievable.
He knows the history of the day. He knows what's going on with the music, the genres that kept changing at that time period. You saw that change in channel days. You saw that. From the weird metal that came in, then all of a sudden you've got heavy metal, you've got Ponce metal, you've got death metal, you've got all these different metals, but then they are flavor of performance art music when people come in with trash cans from Germany. One of them, Tony, was telling me, he says, "Do you remember they went to the dump and they got the stuff out of the dump?"
Eisenstein Neubauten, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but that's one of the German bands that did that. You know, they used big, huge... oil drums.
Oil drums.
Like that. plastic water drums.
Well, yeah, here's the thing. We're going to have to call this now because we're running out of times and stuff in the studio. The thing is, we're going to continue. I'm going to keep in touch because I'd like to talk with you and Catherine about all the stuff that both of you have done.
Yes, Catherine, I wish she could have been on this because Catherine she's an encyclopedia, too.
Exactly.
She's a very talented musician and wrote some of the best songs for the Bentmen. So, you know, she was always there, except for the first 3 years, and then I met her. And then she's been in the band ever since, and the keyboards, guitar, bass, she can play everything, She's an amazing talent, I think, Well, I think everybody thinks,
It's your wife, and you love her. You've got beautiful kids, and you've got beautiful grandkids now, I hear. And so you just got to keep marching on, and you got to keep looking after your health. And having the band name perform every so often, but this time there's no channel to put the third stuff in it, but and all that stuff.
But we had let me finish this one thing with you. I met Multi from the Barbarians. Do you remember them from the
60s? Oh yeah.
Are you a boy or are you a girl?
That's right. Exactly. Yep. I mean, it's just a little ditty, but at the time when they wrote that, 64 or 66 in there, they were one of the only long-haired bands around, a garage band, really. And you don't have enough time for the whole story, but I meet Multi. Fast forward a couple of years, he's doing a show at a VFW in Abington, Massachusetts, and he invites me with a backstage pass and everything. And Tiny Tim is opening for him.
Oh, Tim Cow! Right.
And then Ernie Valens, the cousin of Richie Valens, was playing as well. And he had Donna there, who, Richie Valens wrote that
song. What to talk about.
Donna. Yeah. Right, and she's there, built like a 4'2" fire plug. That's Donna. That's the woman that the song's written about. And she was real sweet, But, when you think of the song. But anyway, so I got to meet Tiny, and I said, Tiny, and he was, you could tell he wasn't feeling very well. And I think he passed away less than a year after he did this. But I said, what would you charge me? I've been doing a show at Mama Ken's Music Hall, and I want you to come out of a box. We're big folks. And would you do it? And he goes, ooh, like that. I can't even get this high, that voice of his. And he brings over his manager, Gil Morse was his name. And he's this little guy. And, he's living in a hotel room, as his permanent place down in Rhode Island. So I got him for $600 to come out and start and play on stage. And the band, the Bentmen, backed him up. Not with any costumes on and stuff. And it was incredible. People were like pointing like, hey, wow, that looks like, wow, that is the guy.
I love it. So, I love it.
Yeah. That was one of our best shows where we had a surprise. It's hard to surprise people.
I love that.
Tiny Tim will do it.
That'll do it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Tiny Tim. Okay.
Well, listen, I love you guys. Thank you for calling me and making me a part of this. And the channel was a very special place for me and my band. And everybody individually in the Bentmen played in different bands there, I'm sure. Thanks again for
thank you. Thank you for being on Two Pints in a Corner. And we will sign out with Des Desmond and the Bent. Men.
Bye-bye, gentlemen.
Take care, man.
Thank you. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye-bye.